Well, good day and welcome back to another great episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I want to welcome everybody here to the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com. We want to thank all of you for checking out the show. We're actually picking up with part two of a segment we started last week with author Kurt Kamm, who specializes in writing about first responders, particularly firefighters and people involved in arson and investigations of things. And we're actually picking up Sam with The Tunnel Visions, his latest novel. And of course, I'm talking to Sam Bradley, my co-host.
Hi there, Jamie. We're trying to stay dry out here in California, doing pretty well, but actually we love having the rain, so that's a good thing. And yes, I'm really looking forward to talking to Kurt about this latest book, because it actually had to do with a time when, well, you and I certainly remember the 70s, but there are a lot of folks out there that didn't. And this particular disaster we're going to be talking about has left the minds of a lot of people. And just the story alone of how he even learned about this and then got excited about writing about it is going to be awesome. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
So without too much further ado, we'll jump right on into the rest of this episode segment we recorded together from last week's episode and talk about the latest effort from Kurt Kamm, Tunnel Visions, coming right up next.
So talk to us about Tunnel Visions. I'm really fascinated with that story. And Jamie, well, I got an extra book I'll send you.
It is really interesting because it's historical fiction part of it. The background is that I was out with LA County Fire Department and Ventura County Fire Department, and we're standing in a railroad tunnel, and they're talking about USAR communications and that sort of thing in this railroad tunnel. And there's this guy standing next to me, and we get to chatting, and he turns out to be a safety engineer, just retired from the Metropolitan Water District, which is the biggest water handler in the United States here in Southern California. And I told him what I did. I said, I'm looking to write another book, and I'm looking for a topic. And this guy said, well, he said, you ought to write about the Sylmar Tunnel disaster. And I said, the Sylmar Tunnel disaster, I've never even heard of it. What is it? So he proceeds to tell me this story, and it turns out that he is sort of the living expert and archivist for this disaster. And in 1971, and the Metropolitan Water District is digging a series of tunnels to take water from really the west side of Los Angeles County out to the eastern part of the county. And the first tunnel was 5.5 miles long. And the men had been digging for about a year, and they were 5 miles in. They were about 1,500 feet from completion. And the disaster occurred in June of 71. In February of 71, we had out here the Sylmar earthquake, and it was a pretty big and devastating earthquake. And one of the things it did was it moved all the geology around in the area where they were digging this tunnel. And the tunnel had gone under an old oil and gas field. And it turned out that after the earthquake, the quake had opened up a lot of gas faults. So these guys are digging, and again, 1971, there was no such thing as OSHA, which I found fascinating. Again, I never really thought about it, but the state of California had an industrial safety board, which it was about to close down because it didn't think it was necessary. And Lockheed, believe it or not, Lockheed, the aerospace company of today, had a subsidiary called Lockheed Construction. They were the contractor. They're digging this tunnel, and they were working three shifts a day, 24 hours a day, and there were about, 20 men on a shift. And they had this 1971 equivalent of an automated tunnel digger, et cetera. Anyway, as they had been digging through this tunnel in the last few weeks, they had been hitting pockets of methane. And the men were getting sick from the gas, and they'd had a few little tiny explosions and everything. And, of course, today there's not a chance in the world that that job would have, you know, not been closed down. Mm-hmm. But in 1971, no one was really watching over it. And the night before the disaster, they had a small explosion in this tunnel. And mind you, now they're 5 miles into the tunnel, okay? And because this is going to be a water tunnel, there's no ventilation shafts. All there was an overhead air line, air vent, that snaked through the tunnel to the digging face so that these guys had oxygen. And the night before, there had been a small explosion, and they took 4 men to the hospital, blah, blah, blah. And the Lockheed safety engineers came back and said, don't worry about it, go back to work. So to make a long story short, the graveyard shift goes on at 12, and at 1 o'clock in the morning, they hit a huge gas pocket, and there is just a god-awful explosion in this tunnel. And I talked to one of the paramedics. This is L.A. City Fire Department that responded. So they got a call, and they show up at the entry of this tunnel, and there is flame and smoke and heat pouring out of this thing, and they are told that there's 18 miners in there, and the firefighters are saying, well, how far in are they? And they're told that they're in 5 miles.
Ugh.
So... and again, this is at a time they did have SCBAs,
right? Yeah.
But they lasted about 40 minutes, and there was this little rail car thing that you could go in. Anyway, the fire burned for 48 hours with heat and smoke before anybody could even consider going in. And I talked to this guy who was a paramedic, and paramedic would be the wrong word because that word wasn't in use. He had had 2 weeks of training in an emergency ward at a hospital.
A first aider. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically. And he was telling me that he said when we finally got ready to go in, he said the first thing that we had on this little rail car was a big barrel of ice water. And I said, ice water? What ice? He said, well, that was what we had for the burn victims. So that will give you some idea of the level of training and competence that this was at the beginning of USAR. There was actually a battalion chief at LA City Fire Department who had been doing a lot of work on USAR. And in the 70s, the first real USAR training was starting, and boy, it was rudimentary. So by the time they got in, you know, to the place where the explosion occurred, everybody was dead. The people that weren't blown apart from the initial explosion suffocated, you know, in a matter of minutes.
I would have thought so, yeah.
Except that it turns out that there was one guy. And when the explosion occurred, the overhead air vent collapsed on top of him. And for 2 days, while the fire was burning, this guy was under this metal air vent, and his face was actually in a puddle of water, and he was getting fresh air. And believe it or not, they pulled him out alive.
Really? Wow.
Through the most bizarre chain of events, I learned his name, and I thought, you know, I'll just see if this guy, because they said he lived in Los Angeles. So I found him. I found him living here in Los Angeles. His name is Ralph Brissett. And I went down to see him, and I told him I was writing a book about this disaster. And, of course, he didn't remember much about the explosion. He didn't remember anything. But we became friends, and he told me a lot about the people that worked in the tunnels and all this sort of thing. And he had devoted the last 40 years to try to get the Metropolitan Water District to put up a memorial. And with a little help from me and some other people, finally the MWD put up a memorial last December.
That's great.
But the story of this disaster was incredible because, I mean, I can't criticize the fire department. I mean, they got there and they had no idea how they were going to get to these people that were 5.5 miles in.
Sometimes you just can't.
They tried to dig rescue shafts, and the shafts collapsed. They went to Universal Studios and got two wind machines and put the wind machines at the end of the tunnel to try to suck the smoke out. And there was just so much gas and burning that, you know, that didn't work. At one point, the miners on the following shift wanted to try to go in and rescue their people, and the police department, the fire department said nobody's going into the tunnel, and they called in the LAPD, and there was actually a near riot between the miners and the police department because the miners wanted to go into the tunnel. They wouldn't have survived 5 minutes.
Didn't see that, though.
Yeah, this is a 1971 disaster. And as a result of it, the state of California decided that they were going to keep their industrial safety division in place and actually passed legislation for tunnel safety, which became the sort of the standard for all of the other states. And there was a safety engineer who was supposed to be supervising this tunnel, and he had come in after the first night's little explosion, and he said, shut this thing down, and they wouldn't do it. And he didn't have any authority, you know, to stop the work. So after this disaster and all these people died, there was a criminal trial. The Lockheed supervisor committed suicide. Another one of the Lockheed engineers was convicted of destroying evidence because he went into the tunnel and took, you know, gas meters and other kinds of things out, so they didn't have it. And in this trial, they found Lockheed guilty of killing 17 of the 18 people. And what's absolutely stupefying is that under the law of the time, it was a misdemeanor.
Really?
And the families then ultimately brought a civil action, and each family got paid about $500,000. But it was weird. And this engineer from the Metropolitan Water District had a lot of this history, and he's one of the few people who'd actually been in the tunnel. They completed the tunnel. They don't use it. They use it once a year or twice a year to send water through it, but it's basically empty. And he's led L.A. County USAR teams through the tunnel on training missions. And I got to tell you, I've been in a part of this tunnel. It is scary. It is absolutely scary because it's about 20 feet in diameter. You access it from a 200-foot shaft from a street on Foothill Boulevard in Sylmar, and there's no light in it. There's, you know, about a foot of water on the ground, and there's all these calcification and stuff on the walls, and it is a scary place.
Wow. Well, it's hard to imagine a time, you know, before paramedics, that was just really the cutting edge of that, before USAR, before, you know, there was any medical training, before even OSHA. I mean, we don't we We don't appreciate those things we have now because you've never lived in a world. Well, we did live in that world, but not in a position where we would notice they weren't there. You know, I mean, we never were able to make that comparison.
Well, and the fire service has been around for many, many, many years, but the type of responders that we have today, especially the cross-trained medical staff and firefighter paramedics and things like that, that is all such a relatively new development in emergency response. And, you know, there's so many technologies and things that have changed just in the last 15, 20 years that have made a huge difference in how people manage and deal with firefighting. So, you know, it's amazing to think about how disaster response to situations like this have changed just in the recent past. And like you said, Kurt, in the memory of one of the people you talked to.
I wrote a paramedic book. So I went down to UCLA Daniel Freeman Paramedic Training School. And
been there.
Have you been there? Okay, well,
I graduated from there, yeah.
All right. Well, if you remember, in the hallway are all those pictures of the history of paramedics.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And as I recall, it was an Australian doctor who first had this idea that doctors would ride in ambulances to emergencies. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't let him do it. They thought this was the craziest, most god-awful thing anyone had ever heard of. And he persisted, and I think over several-year period, finally was the person who was sort of instrumental in getting this idea across that trained medical personnel could respond to emergencies.
Well, and it's really unfortunate because we almost always have Dr. Joe Holly with us, and he is a USAR doc and an ER doc and a number of other things, and he's almost always here. And Jamie just sent me a note, said, boy, he's going to be sorry he missed this one because he would have loved this conversation. He would have had all kinds of questions for you. So we may have to do this again sometime so we can get Dr. Joe on with you.
I can talk, as I say, I can talk for hours. I got all these little stories and everything. Let me tell you just a quickie about tunnel visions. The book I wrote is it takes place in the present, and there's this urban search and rescue firefighter from LA County, and there is his father died in the Sylmar Tunnel disaster.
Mm.
So there's sort of this backstory. How his father died is sort of a mystery, and there's a unexplained stuff that his mother never shared with him before she died, and he's got this sort of black hole in his history. So part of the book is sort of flashbacks to him learning about the Sylmar Tunnel disaster, and the current story is that water terrorists threaten the L.A. water supply. And he and his fiance, who is an ATF agent, are called out to respond to this threat. And it turns out that the threat centers around this Sylmar tunnel. So it sort of makes a loop back on itself. And when he responds to this threat, he finds out things about his father's death. But the Sylmar tunnel is something that, you know, it's sort of faded into oblivion. The people at the Metropolitan Water District who were sort of responsible for the tunnel, most of them had never even heard of this disaster.
Wow.
The CEO there who presided over this memorial, when he got up, he said, I must tell you, he said that until this came up a couple years ago, I had never even heard of the Sylmar Tunnel disaster. So,
well, it may not have been a coincidence that you ran into the guy that day that got you thinking about it. And is it really true that no one's ever written the history of this or told this story before?
Well, there's a book out. The safety engineer, his wife was a journalist, and she wrote a book. It's not a great book, but she wrote a book, but it's more about his struggles, the safety engineer's struggles to rectify what he thought was Lockheed's misdeeds in this. And But no one's ever written really about the disaster. So one of the things that this Metropolitan safety engineer had, he had pictures from the L.A. Fire Department archives that showed this disaster, pictures taken in 71.
Wow.
And they were some of the most gruesome pictures you've ever seen. I mean,
I can imagine.
They showed burned bodies that looked like burnt logs. And,
well, no doubt, as long as they were in there.
Yeah. So the pictures were quite stirring. And we had these pictures, and Ralph Brissett, this man who had been trying all these years to get a memorial, when he got his hands on the pictures, I think that he showed them to the Metropolitan Water District, and they were so horrified that they thought, my God, we've really got to do a memorial.
So. And you got to feel good for having had that opportunity to help this guy out. I mean, 40 years later, he's probably, well, as much as he wanted it, he probably felt he had nowhere to go and nobody had any memory or any interest in doing this. And
you
there
know
you
that
are.
He still suffers from survivor's guilt and PTSD.
Not surprising.
He cannot, because he's never been treated. You know, obviously they didn't even know what PTSD was.
Yeah, we didn't have any of that back then either.
And whenever he starts to talk about this event, he breaks down in tears.
Oh, that's sad. All these years.
It's amazing. It's just amazing.
And that's just another indication of how far we've come, because, you know, we have the critical stress management system in place now, and we have these things that and opportunities and a long history of treating PTSD now,
right,
and understanding a little bit more about what it is. And it is. You know, we've actually done shows on the podcast here, Kurt, that have talked about, you know, the challenges of dealing with the stress of being a responder, and especially in major disaster situations, and having to make those life or death calls and say no one's going in that tunnel. And you know, and those aren't easy decisions to make, because those miners didn't understand. Those firefighters wanted to go in too.
Of course.
Yeah.
Exactly. Sure. The miners had these sort of canvas breathing bags.
Oh, my God.
I did some research about the breathing apparatus, and the miners, of course, they had nothing in the tunnel. They had no safety equipment in the tunnel. But the miners that wanted to go in had available to them these sort of canvas breathing bags that had activated charcoal. And I'm thinking like a gas mask from maybe the First World War or something. And that was all they had available to them.
Well, obviously, this probably drove a lot of changes in safety in those environments. No?
Well, it sure did in California. I mean, they used that disaster for groundbreaking legislation. And that's really the book that this engineer's wife wrote about.
Well, out of something bad, something good will come, and one way or the other.
Yep.
That's what usually happens, even if it's something really bad that causes these, that finally enlightens people enough to say, yeah, these changes need to be made. Or even in the case of your guy finally getting his memorial, I mean, it was really awesome that you could have a part of that. You could get to know this guy. You can become friends with him, and mostly that you helped him get what he's wanted for 40 years.
It was so weird, because before I met him, you know, I had done all this research and read about this guy and everything, and then I found his phone number literally through, I don't know, the internet, doing different kinds of searches. And I had a phone number in Carson, which is where he's supposed to live, for a guy named Ralph Brissett. And I called the number, and I got an answering machine that didn't give any name or anything. It just said, you know, leave a number and I'll call you back. And I explained who I was and everything. And I didn't hear back for weeks. And it was like 2 months later, one day the phone rings, and here's this voice on the other end, and it's this guy saying he's Ralph Brissett, and
he'd like
to meet me. And that was, it was really cool. And then we agreed to meet at a diner out near the Los Angeles airport. And all I really knew about him was he was black. That was the only thing I knew about him. And I said, well, I'll meet you there. So I was out there like a half hour early, and I got a table where I could watch the door and everything. And I sort of imagined, now this guy was going to be in his early 70s. Mm-hmm. And I figured with all he'd gone through, I expected to see a guy with a walker, you know, kind of bent over. Maybe he's trailing an oxygen tank with him or something. And this big, strong-looking guy comes in. He's about 6'1", and this was Ralph Brissett.
Fooled you.
And it blew my mind because it was like seeing a ghost. I felt like I already knew him and knew all these guys that died in the tunnel who were his friends. So when he sat down to talk to me at the table, I thought, geez, this guy's like an old friend already.
Well, and it was probably cathartic, as sad as it might have been, for him to finally, after all these years, have somebody to talk to that understood what happened there and can relate to what he experienced.
I think so. I think so. He read my book, and let me rephrase this. He had a social counselor, and I was in touch with her, and I said, you know, I'm writing this book, and I told her what it was about, and she said, you know, she says, I don't know if he should see this or not. And I said, well, it's your call. You know, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
So then after the book came out, somehow the book got into his hands, okay? Whether the counselor gave it to him or somebody else gave it to him, I'm not exactly sure. But he called me up. He called me up, and he was in tears. And he had read a couple of the first chapters, which describes what went on in the tunnel. And then I have a chapter where my young firefighter meets him out here in Malibu and learns about what happened in the tunnel. And he had read that chapter, and he said, can I get some more books? And I said, sure. I said, how many do you want? And he said, well, I'll call you back. I'll let you know. And then I didn't hear from him. So I thought I just would leave sleeping dogs lie.
Well, in a sad sort of way, I'm sure it did him a lot of good just to have somebody understand. Kurt, I hate to do this, but I think Jamie's gonna. It's his bedtime back here in Maryland, and
okay.
We will do this again. I guarantee you, we will have some more chats about some more things. This was fascinating. But where can people learn about you, about your books? I'm sure everybody's going to want to run out and get a copy of Tunnel Visions.
My name, by the way, is spelled KURTKAMM, and the easiest thing, obviously, all my books are on Amazon, and I've got a neat first responder author website, which is KurtKAM, all one word, .com.
Excellent.
And we'll make sure we have links to both your Amazon page so that people can look at all your books, including Tunnel Visions, and also your website at KurtKAM.com.
That's
so
cool.
You make sure we have a link to that in the show notes for this episode, and everybody can find that there. You know, I'm just thinking about the stuff we covered in this episode, Sam, and
oh my God,
you know, all the things about the advancements and the changes that have occurred just in recent memory, really, and in just a generation ago. And it brings to mind all of the groundbreaking things that, you know, the folks with Joe Holly and Jim Logan are doing with Paragon Medical Education Group, and the way they're bringing their experiential training program to responders all around the country.
Yeah, and that's one thing that actually occurred to me in this conversation. Back then, cops didn't talk to firefighters, firefighters didn't talk to medical people, and to think how And it's been kind of forced because of the types of incidents we've had. And Kurt, you might want to listen to some of those episodes, but talking about active shooter training and some of the things we're doing now, that the real benefit is responders are covering each other. They're talking to each
other.
They have common language. When ICS first, there was no such thing as the incident command system back then, and there were big safety hazards around that. So that's a whole new podcast, but I think that might be something interesting to reflect on sometime.
Well, I can tell you 100 anecdotes. You pick it, arson, paramedics, whatever. And if you want to do this again, I'd love to do it. And thank
you.
We will. For this.
We'd love to have you on, and we'll definitely link back to you. Sam, as we wrap up here, where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, where we hope you will come and ask some questions of Kurt, and I'm sure we can coerce him into answering those for you, and anything you want to know about him or the book. And there you go. And PodMedic, where do we find you?
Well, you said it, PodMedic in most places on social media sites, PodMedic. And of course, you can find this podcast over at disasterpodcast.com. And of course, all my other programs, as well as this one, are over at mediccast.com. And, you know, we just want to remind you that this is a community effort here, and we want to make sure that you are contributing and letting us know what you want more of. Did you like this episode? Do you want more authors in the emergency responder space to come on the show and talk about their books? Do you want Kurt to come back and talk some more about some of the other topics? I know, Kurt, we could probably have you talk about so many other things, and we want to have you back and do that.
I do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, okay. Sam, let's wrap up. And, you know, we've learned a lot about different response again.
And it's amazing. In over a year now, we've talked about so many different things that equate to disasters on some level. So it really shows us that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.